This is Keith Scott Allen of odetocode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from lazycoder.com.
Welcome to this episode of Hurting Code, being recorded on December 16th. Tonight's repeat guest is Scott Bellware, who's a software product designer, developer, product director, and agile coach with a 20-year career in continuous improvement. He's also the man that brought us the Monospace Conference. Tonight's topic is CSS, I believe, because, Scott, you had some issues that you've been talking about on Twitter. You're a little bit unhappy with the state of CSS and web design and how the workflow works.
I'm happy with it as a developer, but unhappy with it as someone who interacts a lot with HTML specialists.
And I was curious, when you were Twittering that, how would you define an HTML specialist?
As someone whose primary skill or you know, their whole bag of tricks or the whole realm within which they work is HTML and CSS.
And they're so deep into the weeds that they're not seeing the bigger picture. That's kind of what I got from it.
Well, that's a side effect, I think. I think that's the result of what comes out of this particular specialization because of its particular cultural and historical context. You know, the way it unfolded led to one of the most specialized kinds of workers that we've ever had on software development or software product development teams.
Interesting. Because there was really two issues I was getting out of this. One was that CSS as a way to express layout and presentation. Well, the presentation part seems to be fine. It's the layout that everyone has a problem with. That's one issue. And then the other issue is the human issue of how people are approaching that and using CSS.
There's the team issue, and then there's the technology issue. And both of these issues are rooted in the specialization that has grown, the extent of specialization, and the cultural particularities of an HTML specialist, which is the other term commonly, I guess we could talk about web designers. You know, this is the term we usually use for this person with the sort of small grab bag of skills that include HTML implementation, CSS implementation, and often illustration work as well, or web graphics, and sometimes extended to things like user experience or interaction analysis.
Right, and so what are the issues there? Is it that people are following too much of an orthodoxy?
Well, we're all following orthodoxies. You know, I think that there's the good thing about orthodoxy is it's almost the same word as dogma. They're both forms, practice forms. They're good ways of teaching and training. So beyond orthodoxy, all specialization is going to tend towards creating its own orthodoxy. You know, it might even be, its own best practices could be seen as an orthodoxy. The issue that I find really interesting with and I'm not going to say web designers, I'm going to say HTML specialists, because I a lot of web designers that I know, are pretty good, at what they do. I think that there's just a missing set of knowledge that comes out of, you know, not being an HTML specialist and being on a software team, that helps you get perspective on what you can do with HTML and CSS implementation. So an HTML specialist is, a role. It's a relatively new role on software teams, you know, within the last, you know, they've been around, but within the last 5 years, they're really, really common, right? So you have those people who just do the CSS and just do the colors and just do the typography. It's really visual. It's very creative. It's very designer oriented. It's also quite fashionable, and it's in the realm of aesthetics rather than software development. And it's a needed thing because, these folks are, were brought into the industry as a matter of necessity. Our applications, you know, programmers have a very hard time sort of getting out of the bits and bytes and seeing, you know, really what a user's experience is from their perspective. You know, not having a mental map of an application when you walk up to an application makes you interact with it differently, as opposed to someone like a programmer who built an application. They already have the mental map, and you know, they don't walk the path that a user walks because they have sort of memorized the circuits, the paths to walk in the application. So the HTML specialist problem comes down to one of, as you stay within a realm of specialization, and within a realm of specialization that is also very culturally distinct, internalized, you know, internally consistent, whatever. Not isolated, but, you know, well, isolated from the rest of software. First of all, in any specialization of that sort, you know, it would be like Lord of the Rings. You create, not Lord of the Rings, Lord of the Flies. It creates a microcosm, and a microcosm creates, some unique ideas, you know, internally consistent ideas, but ever sort of shrinking. So even though the realm of HTML implementation and design is pretty broad and quite fast and growing, when we put it into software product development, the folks with that particular specialization and cultural isolation don't really have a sort of intimate sense of how, of what process is, of what design process is, or what implementation, or what whole product process is. And it creates it's an incomplete understanding of how to do the work. And
all right, can you give me a concrete example of what how specialization would hurt a process, hurt a team?
A concrete example or a concrete description?
Description, sure.
Well, let's see. Specialization causes more difficulties at handoffs.
Okay.
So there's two things that we do with HTML specialists or specialists of any variety. If you had a software development team that was made up of completely of specialists that had, you know, really, you know, an archetype that doesn't exist, a team of specialists who really don't know anything about the work of the people around them, you know. So imagine like DBAs who knew nothing about like middle tier development, like that specialized. As they hand off artifacts one to the other, without knowing what the other person does, those artifacts tend to be built to a purity, right? So I would build a purity of middle tier, and I would use all of the purest of design ideas, all of the purest forms of the practices. The DBA would do the same thing. When you hand off work like that, you lose this quality that is called workability. And workable is something that you can, as it sounds like, work with, right? So if I get your code, I can work with it. It's like livable. I'm not really going to live in it, but I am going to work in it a lot. And the code itself is amenable to being worked. When we have deep specialization in different roles of teams, not necessarily even different stages of a process, you end up with stuff that isn't amenable to each other's work, which causes the handoffs to take a lot longer. And not only that, it causes people to re-implement the other people's work so that they can understand them, which is basically like, you know, building the same component or, you know, making the same investment twice, but only getting, you know, one payback. You're basically paying two times as much. And we see this a lot in web development and web application development, and you see this in the effects of the specialization of, HTML specialists. We'll get the code that was designed and laid out. You also, you know, you can see this, and it comes out in a zip file, probably with the word final in it, like final HTML or final layout or final design. That very, you know, that at the very, very, that very moment, you can see the sort of the distance or the separation from HTML specialists and a software product development team or, you know, an IT team in the notion of final. You know, we don't really have final in product flow or product development. It's always this process of learning, realizing what we hadn't taken into account and making changes.
If
the work that comes to me isn't workable, meaning I can't really work in it, then it's usually built that way because the person who gave me the work thought that the work was final and done.
It's like the DBA who would create something that we find out we can't test this for some reason. It's got some non-deterministic
Or the programmer that handed off something to the DBA that is, you know, simply not possible within the realm of, you know, disk storage, data storage. Same thing. Right? So it's just the basic old, you know, age-old plea for generalization. But, you know, what's good about generalization is you don't really have to have complete generalization. You have to have generalization specifically shaped to the people on your team, and you shape it around the places where there are gaps between people. And once you've seen gaps between people, like, that's where a handoff is going to be. It might not necessarily be between different, like, spaces in a process. We usually say there's a gap between a handoff at analysis to design, design to, you know, interaction design off to coding and implementation, you know, and then, you know, those handoffs are there, but they're usually there because there are people with gaps between them that have, you know, been, you know, stuck into these gaps, or these gaps have been created because we create, you know, specializations and you know, specialized work, which isn't bad. You know, specialization gets us through, but if we don't manage the connections between people who are specialized in a better way, so to close them up, we'll end up with these people building towards their own sense of what is right without understanding what needs to be done for the next person who's got to work on this or that.
Well, so I haven't worked on any teams where we've had just a single point of HTML specialization, because mostly what I've done is you know, teams have been compiled to work on web projects, you know, projects that are for the web. So they have to have some understanding where they just, you know, they're not on the team. But I have had some instances where me and other people have been better at JavaScript, HTML, and CSS than some other members. And by better, I mean more knowledgeable about the quirks that are, you know, inherent in the process. And so we did sort of have this problem that you're speaking of, where during the handoff, you know, they wouldn't always understand the JavaScript or the CSS that we were doing, and we wouldn't necessarily like the way that they were solving the problems using JavaScript CSS. But we found that we mitigated these by pairing up. Mm-hmm. So it was almost like a apprentice master, you know, but I wouldn't say I was a master. I mean, let's say junior, senior, more experienced, less experienced. When we would work on these problems, and I was wondering what everyone thought about using that kind of approach to kind of mitigate these things. Cause we didn't really have the handoff where we would say, here, it's, you know, I have, you know, committed my genius to the repository, and now it is your job to, you know, carry the ball from here, kind of thing.
That's happening on a project I'm currently working on with a web startup here in town, and it's a team of three technologists, two people here in Austin, but we also have one person in Serbia. Because there's two of us here in Austin, we're trading off a lot of skills through pairing, and we're learning a lot more from each other, and my partner Marcus is getting really much more accustomed to HTML and CSS because of this necessity. But we also have a web specialist in Europe, and you know, we can't really sit and pair with that person, so you know, it's coming up with the means to close these gaps sometimes when there are, you know, natural obstructions between us that, you know, you that are going to make that gap, you know, you're never going to get rid of some aspect of the gap, and it keeps having its divisive effects. So I think one thing that, you know, is interesting to look at that comes out of all this is our beliefs about HTML and CSS layout and purity, and why we're doing a lot of this stuff with CSS. And I've been making a joke lately that I would start a no CSS movement to companion the NoSQL movement, and sort of maybe drive people back to considering the value of certain HTML primitives that we have dismissed and created a sort of a prejudice or a bigotry about. And I call it bigotry because I think it's arbitrary. You know, it's as arbitrary as the color of your skin. And, you know,
so you're primarily talking about tableless layouts, right? Would that be the primary instigator? Kind of?
I think that's the crux issue. And I think that there's a whole lot of other issues around this. Like, well, why would you create, you know, a button with an href around an image when you should really float or, you know, negative margin the button text off the left of the screen and set a background image for a button rather than putting an a href around an image tag. So this is a common good, web purity. But when I look at it and I try to get real, I use my engineering and my software and my modeling mind and try to get real, find the abstraction between the both of them that sort of make them peers of some proto pattern from the HTML past. I find it really hard to do. I find looking at these two implementations, I find it hard to, if I set my mind to not valuing either one over the other and doing a thought experiment and then rolling back the values that I had on them, I find it hard to have the same love for CSS purity that I had learned to have. And I think that my love for CSS purity really came from just sort of a cultural wave. People just started going that way, and we started at some point in our lives, we heard, hey, table layout, is for suckers. You should really, the way to do it now is CSS. And I know that there are great valuable reasons for doing this, and I agree with some of them. Well, I agree with many of them if I can put them into contexts that are, as pure as the ideas about implementation that you come up with when you live in a deep specialization.
Well, so
when I look at divs, and I use divs for layouts, there's no doubt. But when you look at CSS layout, and I think back to what we used to do with tables, I kind of wonder how we developed such a deep cultural value around these HTML primitives that basically, create arbitrary divisions on a web page. And then we set about to use other primitives to reconstruct, this other thing. It's kind of, when you think about, there's only one HTML primitive in the whole info set whose sole purpose it is to be a grid.
That's a good point. I think one thing, though, that was specifically with the table thing, and this is, getting pretty micro with it, but when you set things up in a grid, you're specifically saying, okay, this thing goes in the upper left corner of the screen, and it will always go in the upper left corner of the screen. You know what I'm saying? And then, so you put things and it is kind of, it's a brittle design. It's not something that's changeable. So
it's a rigid design.
Yes. It is rigid. And in a lot of cases, a lot of people that, that's okay. But I do think that it is something that really people don't know. If that's how you always do things, you don't know what you're missing, kind of, because I know that a lot of people will say, well, it's, you never actually use CSS to redesign a web page, but I've done it, and it's beautiful. And I love to be able to say yes to a customer. Like they'll say, hey, is it possible to do this? And is that going to take weeks? And you say, no, I'll have it done in a half hour. And it's great to be able to do that, mm-hmm. And so that's one place where, the taking the time to set things up without using tables for layout does give you a lot more flexibility in terms of redesign down the road.
So I think on the halfway point between 1995 and today, and I think where that point can be, if you're looking for sort of a common trait of people at this point, I would describe it as the people who rely on grid frameworks. So I'm in that camp. I rely on grid frameworks. I'm still thinking in terms of, a Cartesian plane where I want elements to be. So
yeah.
Either way, right? Even if you're using, let's say you make everything absolute position, right? You're still laying things out in a grid.
Mm-hmm.
Even when elements overlap each other creatively, it's still a grid. It's still Cartesian. We're still doing that. I understand the other benefits of, what happens when an alternative user agent uses your site and the rendering that you've built for a certain form factor really doesn't fit and you really want the ability to have your UI adapt to different form factors, right? So that's a really specific context. And you just simply may not have that in your requirements. And for as many people who are building websites so that screen readers can use them, if you've ever sort of looked at your web logs to see how many screen readers are hitting your site, that's a really good place to start before deciding whether or not to pursue a set of design patterns that are intentionally very pure.
So there's a few other reasons to use CSS layouts over table or traditional kind of grid HTML layouts. These things. So primarily performance related. So things like, you know, tables sometimes can take longer to render. And this is all very contingent, which is why, you know, I consider trying to go pure CSS on a lot of things to be a premature optimization, which is kind of an overused term, but still true. So you have to really look at things like Y-slow and page speed and,
I think
to measure it. Yeah.
Most highly specialized design purities are a premature optimization. So that's really the issue we're talking about when we talk about the industrial process problem of all of this. So I think an interesting aspect of the conversation we had over the last 5 minutes is just, you know, we kind of, you know, play the roles of two archetypes in the software and the web development world, the pro and the con for CSS. And we could probably argue that, you know, that thing back and forth for at least another 5 minutes. But the issue comes back to, at least if we can recognize that we're pursuing a design purity without actual consideration for the requirements that we have in these applications, it starts to look a little funny. Even if you agree 100% with 100% pure CSS layout, just the notion that we have something like this in our process, in the software development process, where we know that premature optimization gets us. And if we conceive of this as premature optimization, it starts to become a different kind of question. A question of whether we're making the right trade-offs for the work that we have to do to build a whole software product. But the web development or the HTML specialization that we have in place right now allows this bubble of this sort of, a cognitive bubble to sort of sit over that part of the process where we don't even question it. We don't even question whether or not it's premature optimization. It's just allowed to be. Like, that's the way web development is done. We don't do that with, you know, middle tier coding or our web coding or service coding, but here we have this one realm and we're basically going to say that, you know, this way of doing it is good. And it's not that it isn't good. It's just that it can be very counterproductive on a team in a process where these very pure implementations come from a very specialized field that socializes more amongst its own members than, you know, sort of in the members of, you know, geek product software people teams, then we start seeing a team management issue or a productivity management issue or a production management issue. And I think we can see manifestations of this in the things that we were talking about earlier. When we get a set of, pages from a HTML specialist to integrate into an application, it can often be a very, very painful and costly process. And it's more so usually than, working with a DBA and doing handoffs of queries or optimization plans. So, yeah, that's what I think about it.
It seems like you're pointing out earlier the whole thing of specialization and focusing on a micro section of it. I've been thinking recently that the goal of web development is to put HTML images and CSS and, you know, a little JavaScript, but basically to put HTML on a page. Like, so if you're working as part of a web development team, you're an HTML developer. Like, and that's something where, like, everyone on the team should feel, you know, feel like that's our craft, you know, like so user experience people, the designers, the, you know, production content editors down to somebody, you know, writing the, writing the service layer. I mean, I feel like if you're on a web development team, you know, this is our craft. And so to that end, like, I feel like we shouldn't, I've worked on some teams where everyone really cared about, you know, doing things like got into the HTML and CSS side of it. And it was really like, it was really invigorating and it was cool to be able to, like, you know, blast stuff out that was really high quality.
Well, it would also be cool if, you know, that's an instance of the class of behaviors of people getting engaged in developing deeper skills in a broader range of fields, right? So that's always going to be invigorating. So there's no doubt that that can't be true. But it would also be true if, you know, they also got involved in, you know, the nitty gritty of service bus, if they had a service bus in play, or query optimization, if they had a relational database in play. I wouldn't use this argument to justify, you know, playing to the lowest common denominator. But what if you had a team that was getting into the HTML and they had, you know, a middling knowledge, which is, you know, basically what I would call my knowledge, a web developer who uses a grid framework and who gets tense when he sees, you know, absolute and relative in a style sheet. What if that was the depth of experience for everybody on your team, but you established a standard on the team that said we don't ship unless our CSS and HTML represents a level of purity or an absolute purity. You know, since we're doing a thought experiment here, let's say it was absolute purity. You probably would absolutely never be able to release your product.
Mm-hmm.
So if you plot that on a continuum from that, you know, that absurd absolute to the absurd, you know, people don't even know how to write, you know, the HTML tag, somewhere in the middle there, or some point along that line, there's there's your team of middling HTML CSS people. And further along that line towards the absolute purity is, an HTML specialist. If the HTML specialist's level of skill dictates when the HTML is of sufficient quality to release, then that person is naturally going to be the bottleneck.
Yeah, I guess
you have a team of five people, and you have a level of skill that you could say, like, this is the funnel we have to squeeze ourselves into. We're not going out until we do. So what if you wouldn't have to use like an HTML table to lay out like the header and the footer and the crazy stuff we used to do. But, you know, you get into these micro situations where you're between two rails in your application, a left and a right, and you want to get this other thing that looks like a table into play because it's left and right things that are side by side. And you know, you just simply can't figure out the layout. So, and I think as we've learned HTML and CSS, we've all come into these circumstances where we're like, you know, right here in this one little spot right here, if I used a table for these, you know, three rows and two columns, I would rock it out and I would be done right now. So that's the question of, you know, is that screwing the pooch? You know, we have lots of things like this in software development. Is it screwing the pooch when you do that? Is it screwing the pooch when you write your code before you write your tests, or you don't submit new code with 100% test coverage? These kind of things. I mean, is it something that you send the code back for, or is it something you move forward on?
I don't think that any kind of CSS purity is something that you lose sleep or ship time over. This is my personal opinion. I also don't think that pure XHTML conformance is something that you should sacrifice shipping for. That being said, I do think that, you know, things like page size, render time should be requirements, should be considered in the design and the overall acceptance of the final product. And if you can shave off an extra 20 KB on a page, even after it's gzipped, by using a CSS layout or a grid, you know, CSS grid layout versus large tables, then I think that's something to take into consideration.
So I would put that work at the end of the functional implementation.
I think that's hard though, because a lot of the time, if you look at that kind of thing as something you can optimize later, it's kind of like saying, let's just rock out all this code and we'll write the tests at the end of the project. It's something where it's maybe even harder because it's really hard to retrofit.
I think you're right. And I think we've dealt with that problem. So you use the analogy of writing tests. I think we've dealt with that problem in a very natural way or in a way that in similar circumstances like this tend to evolve towards this behavioral pattern where we do things in smaller and smaller chunks and we do things together, right? So now we're writing a little bit of test code and a little bit of functional code and a little bit of test code and a little bit of functional code. And we've learned to make the amount of stuff that we do smaller.
And we also learned that having a test team that's in a different building or a different section of the building is a lot more difficult than just having everyone trying to work together, being in the same room, being able to communicate every day. Is it just the case that the HTML specialist is just still considered a different part of the team? They're in a different room?
I think they're considered a wholly different profession. We tend to not have agencies in the software development world whose sole purpose is to provide database administrators, or let me say data storage specialists. There are a few consultants out there that do this for specialization. But in the design industry, we have, you know, a historical set of design houses that were doing print media who had the necessary aesthetic and spatial relations skills to do interactive media as well. But, you know, they are still design agencies. And we still have people, and not everyone, but there's a disproportionate number of HTML specialists working offshore, away from the shores of the product team that they need, that they should be integrated with, and have them working in design houses. And doing things like sending zip files that say, that have the word final in them, and handing off one large pile of work that has been optimized for the end state before we've even gone through the process of uncovering, you know, the missed assumptions or the assumptions that we know are going to happen when we start, you know, uncovering understanding with a software development project. You know, I mean, these things tend to behave like whittling knives. You take a software development to a business and it starts to peel back the a software development project to a business and it peels back the onion onto the businesses. All of the understandings and all of the intentions come up in detail. You know, so that's why we don't do giant piles of design up front anymore, right? Because we know that the plan doesn't survive the battle. But really doing this giant pile of design up front is the default way of doing business with most HTML specialist design houses. And much of the culture of people who work in this industry tend to emulate, you know, the design houses, the design house culture, more than the, you know, corporate IT software development team culture. Meaning that they tend to protect their separatism.
But sure, you see that everywhere. I think we've reached the point in the podcast where Kevin will speak.
I want to make one comment going back to something Scott said and then ask a question. Sorry. I was going to say that probably wasn't specific enough. Scott Kuhn. You know, when you talk about things like, having page size be a criteria for completion, I think even that is totally context dependent. I mean, for an enterprise application that is going to be delivered over a gigabit Ethernet connection to 100 users, who cares if there's 20K worth of extra markup in there? It's a total non-issue.
Or page view state.
Or view state.
Who cares if there's tests around that?
the point being that, you know, that's fiddling over, you know, HTML optimization in that case is a total waste of time.
Well, it's a possible waste of. I'm sorry, this is not Scott Kuhn, but it's a possible waste of time if you don't have that requirement and you code for. You know, it's basically like, you know, your business sponsor coming up to you and saying, "Hey, I saw this in the system. You know, nobody actually asked for that." It's like, yeah, well, you know, I thought I'd put it there. I was sort of interested in practicing one of those this week.
So my question is to you, Scott Belware, to what extent do you think this sort of this odd HTML specialization is a historical byproduct of the fiddliness of the web? I mean, the problems of cross-browser implementations, and there's sort of a specialized, there has historically been a specialized skill there because the web has evolved in such a fucked up way.
So those specializations become, they come online. You know, they're in play when we delve further and further into those not lowest common denominator tricks of web design. There is a solid core around the middle that, you know, you can count on in most browsers and, you know, decent CSS or JS frameworks will compensate for the fiddliness that can be compensated for. And then we, you know, and then we go outside those, you know, and then we get into the little, layout things that happen when you're, you know, on one browser or another. So yeah, definitely brings the need for that specialization into play. And the reason we're bringing that specialization into play is because most people on the team don't really get that depth of, haven't really done that depth of study in layout and how layout is randomized by browser implementation.
Yeah, I kind of feel
that's what I mean by the workability issue, right? So when you're working within code that has been optimized, you're working in code that lacks workability, right? You take out, you know, if you opened up jQuery and, you know, you could read it, but if you opened up the minified jQuery, you'd have a more difficult time, right? So that's, you know, optimized versus non-optimized code. You know, there's a workability difference. So what if you brought that low workability because of high optimization into the project at the very, very first day that the developers start to work, which is what happens when we bring HTML specialists in upfront? You end up integrating application interaction with static web design, where that static web design is optimized and specialized enough so that it lacks workability. And that's the industrial process problem. And that's the problem that we're not really addressing, I think, in the web design sphere, because we ourselves don't see web designers as people who are on our team. You know, the fact that, you know, some of these guys are sort of separate, you know, has also influenced our own, you know, natural concepts of them. You know, we believe that's true, and it is true. And frankly, they are kind of, you know, people of a different type of, you know, brain setup, than geeks. Nonetheless, when we come together in an industrial process, the rules of that process are still in play. And I think what we're doing with HTML specialization is ignoring these rules of process, and that there's more to doing it wrong than not optimizing your app for high load, if you have a high load app, or not optimizing, you know, your app for screen readers for the unsighted. You know, especially if you do not have screen readers in your application. If you are building, I don't know, if you're building, you know, if you're building a website that, you know, is geared at selling specialized steering wheels to high performance rally cars, you know, or you sell telescopic sights for high dollar hunting rifles. Let's say your business does that online. You could probably make a bet that you're not going to get a lot of screen readers in the weblog, right? There's could be not a lot of unsighted people seeking out specialized optics for hunting rifles. That might be a safe bet to make. And then you'd be faced with this other question. Well, how much HTML purity rules, design rules do we need to put in play if these are the rules that support having a website that's amenable to an unsighted user? And I, you know, I remember when this transition from, you know, like crazy, wacko, weird, you know, blink tag, center tag, and HTML table stuff, you know, start to change into, you know, the days of CSS purity. A lot of the, you know, reasoning was around Section 508 compliance. And even Section 508 compliance is sort of, you know, being reconsidered at this point. So I'm not saying that we shouldn't do that kind of thing, but I'm, you know, and I'm not trying to say, you know, like unsighted people don't deserve equal access to the internet. But I think that there are some applications that are truly not amenable to those circumstances, and we shouldn't be pre-optimizing for them. Because if you put that pre-optimized code in before developers, and it's final layout, and you put it in before developers sit down to integrate the interactive application, they are going to find themselves in a realm of HTML that they have to fit things into that they're going to have a hard time living in and working in. And that's going to slow them down, and that's going to be a productivity problem. And you know, you absolutely know that when you start bringing the application into play, that new knowledge surfaces and new fields come into play and new sequences of using the app comes into play and the implementation of the HTML changes, and then the developers are there, right? The developers are there to make those changes. But if they're looking at highly specialized, specialized to a purity, specialized to an absolute extreme, if they're working with that code, they are going to have a harder time making those necessary in-flight changes than you would have if you had an HTML specialist. Well, if your HTML specialist works on a different sleep cycle and lives on a different side of the world from you, you know, you're now talking about bottlenecking and process issues. And, you know, all of these problems that come from having the one-person bottleneck. And this doesn't justify going back to HTML tables. And all of the, you know, the interesting arguments that we were having, you know, for and against previously still don't justify going back to this, you know, crazy, you know, GeoCities, unless you like that kind of thing. I think probably the GeoCities aesthetic is probably going to come back. You know? I mean, if big sunglasses could come back, GeoCities could come back.
We can hope so.
So,
John, you have a question?
Well, yeah, you know, I was just, as you were talking about this, I was thinking the weird way that the web developed, it definitely, like, there were a lot of competing ways of working with the HTML tool set. And then if you look back historically, you can see that some people were doing things the way that kind of won out. And they've been doing it for a long time, right? And it's just, but there are also a lot of other wacky ways of doing things. Like jQuery runs on IE6, you know? And like, it took people a while to figure out like, oh, this is the clean way of doing JavaScript. And the same way, like a lot of, like, if you approach markup right from the beginning, it's not incredibly difficult to do good things, even back to IE6 or like good layout for everybody and like workable for IE6.
So I think the answer to this is an answer that we already have, that we, you know, it's a way of doing the software development game that we have been doing. And we're just simply not seeing that we should be applying this to HTML as well. And often this is difficult when we have these cultural gulfs between, you know, these two different kind of workers, or you have this, you know, part of the cultural difference between HTML specialists and Luddites is the belief in the value of using the purity always, the pure form always. I forgot the point I was going to make, but damn, it was sounding good.
Well, how about we do this? How about we turn the tables? Because just a couple months ago, John had a blog post that was essentially describing this scenario where you had HTML specialists who were designing things in Photoshop and chucking it over the wall to developers who said, web developers who say, yeah, I know HTML and I know enough CSS to get by. But John said he has worked in a mythical land where developers and designers actually work together and it's really efficient and they produce high quality stuff. So we want to turn the tables to John and say, how do you reach that point? How do you get there?
Was it a rattlesnake bite?
You know, I think that it really comes from the whole thing of looking at the HTML and CSS as the product and looking at it as, you know, like this is, we're going to, like, high quality HTML and CSS is what matters most to your end users. I mean, without taking it to extremes, but I've worked, we've all used websites that work just great that ran on Cold Fusion or, you know, like had access tables in the background, but the site worked great for us, you know? And so I think that it should be a value that people really care about. I think too, the you know, like people said earlier, the things have evolved to a really weird point. And one really bizarre thing is that we all started with ViewSource and we all monkeyed with HTML. And we really think that tables are easier because that's what we all learned along the way. But if you actually start from day one and you look at the, you know, the float model and you learn that at the beginning, I mean, tables are really kind of bizarre in a way how they work. And so I feel like, you know, a lot of the time the same way that, you know, people say like, oh, we don't have time for tests. Let's just do it this way. And to me, like I've done the whole div CSS thing for long enough that to me, it doesn't seem faster to say, okay, I'll just do this in tables for now. Like it's a practice. You gotta work at it.
Well, so I think the one thing that the CSS purity argument misses is that CSS is horribly broken, and not just across browsers. You know, even if you pick something that implements the spec perfectly, you still end up with tons of CSS that is very fragile and very dependent upon the data.
Each other.
and each other. And I think Float is an excellent example of that. Float is left over from the old print days and has no place whatsoever in a digital display. And yet, you know, that, you know, every, if I had a nickel for every time I've seen, you know, Float, clear, both. Float, left. Float, right. Float, clear, both. And just, you know, just wrapping things in divs and applying a clear, you know, clear left, just to get things to line up again.
I think the interesting thing about CSS as a, if we look at it like as programmers, and if we look at it as a programming language, it's a really interesting phenomena of a programming language that I don't think that we would really take seriously or find acceptable if it was the a programming language. CSS is basically a programming language that has like it's like a programming language that behaves like a keyboard. It's got keys that when you press them do certain things, and then it's got an alt key, a function key, and a control key that make the keys behave differently. And this is kind of like what CSS as a language is like. You're doing things with CSS, putting these instructions in play, unless you've hit the alt key. And now they all behave differently in that context.
And sometimes different browsers will right. pre-press some of those keys in certain situations for you. And, right. and that's where the horribly broken across browsers.
Can you imagine a for loop that worked in reverse if you put, an if statement
you wrapped it within front of it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, that's what CSS is. Sorry, I got excited.
So by the time that you get done, normalizing your pure CSS layout across all the browsers, or at least just your target browsers, even if you're just trying to get IE6 and 7, if you're an enterprise person, let's say, all the IT people are on 7, they got to use your app, and all the sales guys are on IE6 and, like Windows ME or something, and they've got to use that. Just if you normalize just between those, your CSS layouts, you're still going to end up with such a fragile layout that if you try to, if someone comes along and says, we need to put this little badge right there next to that. You're in for at least a good 2-3 hours of tweaking and pixel pushing around, putting in things. Okay, margin left 10 pixels. God, no. Margin left 20 pixels. Okay.
Clear, oh, wait, no, boat, that doesn't work. Margin that left doesn't work. 20 I use, pixels. I used the for loop three lines back, and margins basically don't have effect in this circumstance.
But, exactly. Oh, I forgot. I forgot. Positioning was relative here. So
do you guys really hit that if you use a CSS reset?
Yes.
Because I don't.
The problem with the CSS reset is it only runs like once in a big batch at the top. And every now and then, I just want a piece of markup that I can put in my markup and say, like, behave yourself tag, But it's really...
if you're dynamically adding things to the page via JavaScript.
It's really a tag that would say, make me understand this. And the real issue with, CSS as a language is... it's a language whose instructions change, really dramatically based on an almost infinite permutation of contexts where, the interaction between other language primitives change the behavior of other language primitives. It's like a programming language that behaves like whack-a-mole.
You're right. And
as a programming language, that's really not acceptable, but as a language that's trying to describe print layout, it kind of makes sense, right? So the interesting thing about this, print layout is if you go back to the HTML specialist worker and you sort of, examine or think about the way an HTML specialist does, his work or her work to get to that point where they can zip up a folder and call it final design. It's still mostly the context of the designer person is still really embedded into print because you get final markup that doesn't take interaction into play, right? You get final markup and you're going, well, that's really cool, except these fields need to have validation messages on them when they're wrong, and this is all butted up against something, and I can't really there's no place to put the other bits of layout that go in here when the best case scenario is not in fact realized. And that's really sort of print mentality.
You know what's interesting is I came across a paper recently that was published in, I think it was 97 or 98, where people recognized some of the flaws that were going to be in CSS. And they said that one of the things we should really have is constraints. So the ability to say that this is going to be so many pixels, and it's never going to be wider than this other thing we've described. I can look in that in the show notes. But after reading through that paper, I thought, wow, that would be really useful. But I also think it's interesting that, to some extent, programmers have tried to tackle this problem and head on with frameworks like Leth. You've run into
no,
Leth.
But I think the problem with those kind of things is they're still dealing within this medium, the CSS medium, that, you know, it itself. I mean, I would love to see, you know, great, finish CSS 3 and HTML5, and let's move on, and just tear the whole thing down to the ground. Or, you know, build an HTML as well. HTML5 is supposed to be, you know, built for applications, but, you know, CSS3 is still, I mean, it's all still like, let's build an application in a document. Like, the whole thing is not let's build, you know, built for applications. It's built for applications in documents, right? That's still sort of the problem. I mean, the whole thing would be great if we could, you know, create a whole brand new thing, but I don't think that, I mean, I think that would take a hell of a lot of courage. And I don't think it turns out to be Silverlight either. You know, it doesn't, you know, the answer to this has traditionally been, well, use Flash or use Silverlight. And, you know, the crazy thing about those tools, I mean, they do bring a new standardized markup language in play. But the moment you build a user interface that way, you automatically incur the cost of a whole other really much more elaborate architecture. Application architecture or network architecture, right? Like, everything goes from being having the ridiculous simplicity of terminal mode UI to client server UI, like, just like that, just by switching to that stuff.
I generally call it cutting off your nose to spite your face, but your mileage may vary.
So, I mean, it's neat stuff that you get this great, you know, this, wow, look, that a markup language that, you know, I can understand. Well, if you can understand XAML, in any case. But, you know, you trade that off and you say, but, you know, I'm going to run everything as a messaging app. And every interaction I make about everything is all going to be messaging. And, you know, that's like taking every single web application you build and make every single interaction an AJAX call.
Yeah, absolutely. Right.
So, you know, except you get, you know, these frameworks to help you do this, you know, like, you know, to reduce the complexity, reduce the concept count, like WCF and its concept count reduction wonderment.
Right.
Okay, so we're off now. I'm sorry.
It's just address binding and contract.
The point I wanted to make earlier, and I'm sorry for jumping around, but, you know, I was talking about, we have an answer to this in the here and now, and it's the way we tend to work right now. And that's, we tend to work in small batches. We work well now, you know, at, you know, extreme programming as it's seeped into the mainstream culture in little ways. Is, you know, a lot of people know that it's smart to do things in little small steps, you know, rather than having great big steps, like a big file full of final design HTML that also doesn't take into context interaction, new knowledge discovery, and the level of specialization or understanding of the workers, downstream workers who are going to work with these things. But if we worked in, if we just used the, you know, the approaches that we already have at our disposal, HTML, working with HTML specialists becomes, a treat. If you ask for little bits of HTML a little bit at a time, and you start with a very basic, you know, core implementation, you know, lo-fi, very simple implementation of the forms and interactive pieces and application pieces, specifically application pieces, and then don't do this final design thing and just say, hey, I need to know the HTML for this. Here's the simple markup of the application. Can you do that? And you know, you end up with this other kind of pair programming or ping pong kind of work relationship that does work. It's just friggin' obvious. So, you know, you go back to your shop and you're like, well, we're building a web app. Well, let's go hire the design company. Oh, here's the design company. They gave us Photoshop. But for another, you know, $5,000, they'll cut it up into HTML. And here's the HTML. We have all the HTML for the application, you know. And that plan simply doesn't survive the battle. But if you get those people in play where you can, you know, put little bits of demand on them here and then, have them lay down a very, very thin, thin, thin slather of markup and layout. And also, to do it in the templating language that your team works in.
Yeah, I really agree that I mean, what you said there about the small batches makes total sense, because it's integrating them into the workflow cycle, as opposed to thinking of it as this is a one time, like, we're going to build some crap and then we're going to slap a pretty face on top of it.
That's the same problem though, right? It's just you put the different people at different ends of the line. Mm-hmm. But still, let's do all of that kind of work and then we'll do all of that kind of work. Right? It's the same way no matter who's at the beginning or who's at the end. It's still the same problem. It's a big batch problem. And big batch problems are basically, what I said handoff and you said integration, it's really the same, two sides of the same coin.
Right. So if you're working as a team and you're working all together, like the design, the HTML work goes on through the project, the DBA or the data work goes on through the project, the middle tier goes on through the project, it's all one team effort. Then when you get done, you've got the best of everyone working together and you've got something where you can continue to work on that, as opposed to like, okay, we got this HTML zip file or whatever and we integrate it once and there's no way that anyone's ever going to be able to continue work off of that.
It's write once work. What do you do with write once work? You rewrite it.
So wait a second.
Right? That's the absolute guarantee of write once work, is it will be written twice, or at least twice.
You guys are putting the autistic programmer right in the same room as the sexually deviant designer?
Officer, I'd like to report a fantasy.
Just trying to tick everyone off in this show.
I think NRA members
are calling us.
So even though the designers are going to go to one cocktail lounge or coffee house at the end of the day, and the programmers will go, to Chili's, when they're working together in a tight loop, those spaces establish their own cultural bubbles, like two soap bubbles clicking. Oh, that's – never mind.
Well, one other benefit of like you pointed out with that, with working together on stuff, is I'm thinking back, and when I finally got Float was when I worked very closely with a very good designer, like HTML oriented designer, and like going back and forth with him, and I would tweak something and be like, okay, well, that doesn't really work. Let me show you how to do it. And I picked up so many skills from him.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, because you learned that craft in the context of the patterns of the problems that you're actually having. It's like somebody wrote one of those, recipe books, cookbooks, specifically for you.
Mm-hmm.
And the learning is, incredible in those times. So the interesting thing about that is the learning, if you can imagine two cycles of, airflow, or two marquees going different directions, but they're sort of circles and they intersect. That's kind of what the work of working together in a cross-functional team, where, I know a little bit more about what the guy next to me does and he knows a little bit about what I do. So when we come together to integrate, and we do integration together, I trade skills off to him, he trades skills off to me. But the real issue there, what happens there is that the integration work is done by both the people at both edges of the handoff, right? And what we get with specialization, when we mix it with cultural separatism, we get handoffs that don't happen with people working together. We get handoffs that happen over email. So that's the other side of this problem. It's like, not only do we have a little industrial process problem, but we've also complicated with this really sort of arbitrary social separatism. And it comes out of the history of design and where HTML design is being done. I mean, it's being done in separate offices with IKEA furniture, not in these, underground basements that we work in writing code. And so we don't interact because we've created this specialization. We've taken the specialization and we've made the specialization even more egregious. We've developed even ever more esoteric ways to re-implement the table tag using other HTML primitives. And we've combined that whole thing with this context of people that don't have any understanding of product development process and continue to sort of become this, more and more insular thing, winding itself tighter and tighter and tighter, where it really needs to be an integrated part of the whole process. And, regardless of the conversation of HTML versus CSS, we are really talking about a whole cultural identity that suggests that only the pure form can be the form that goes into an integrated whole. And that's typically not a, that's kind of like a, it's very difficult to pull that one off in the physical realm of work. So what do we do about it?
I drink a lot.
We bang John, it. We bang John, the problem.
John Galloway, what do you say?
Well, you're the guest. You're supposed to answer the questions. I don't know this.
We apply lean principles to it and Kanban it. Yeah.
If some one other person mentions Kanban, I'm gonna hang myself. No, just leave it alone.
Kanban.
Yeah. Probably what we need is a web application that represents Kanban.
I think there's principles in play and you can refer to them by a fashionable hip foreign sounding name or we can just talk about the principles, and the principles are there real simple. Work with smaller amounts of stuff so that you're having smaller amounts of handoffs and do more integrated work, and always find ways to create at the handoffs create more integration and create more knowledge exchange. Well, it's not even an exchange usually. It's usually just a bleed. You put like two people together with different skills doing integration work together, and the necessary understanding that they have, to work with each other bleeds onto each other. It's not a pretty sight.
This is a good thing, bleeding onto each other?
Welcome to my cubicle. I would now like to open a vein for you. A vein of knowledge.
Well, so would it be a fair summary to say that, this style of, here's the final HTML design is just another form of big design up front that doesn't,
work. It is big design up front, absolutely. It's not another form of it. It is big design up front.
I was going to say, is the solution to just take this scenario and back it up 10 years and have everyone read the Kent Bent work?
Wouldn't it be amazing if HTML specialists understood structural design principles that apply to software, that apply to the applications that their final static HTML is going to become a part of? What if they understood those? Like separation of concerns, like interface segregation, like isolation, right? These are all the principles that describe the problems that we get when we get highly specialized, highly pre-optimized HTML, and we have to make a change to it to incorporate new understanding, and we change it, and everything breaks. And it breaks so badly that we don't understand it, so we re-implement it, right? This is the right once code. What do you do with it? You rewrite it. You rewrite it so that you can understand it, so that it becomes workable.
You've broken the flow then. I mean, then it's like you said, it's a one-off thing.
Well, I mean, you've basically just doubled the cost, slowed everybody down. All of the value that you're getting out of design is really thrown away. The value of the web designer is going away. It's all because of this, It's all because of this absence of isolation, the quality of isolation in design. I changed this one thing. Everything else broke. We're dealing with highly specialized. I can't understand it. Doesn't have to be highly specialized at this point of the development, but it is, because that's the way it was chose to be optimized up front. Not only big design up front, but pre-optimization combined with a professional culture that doesn't really integrate and interact on the same level as everybody else. I mean, it's the perfect storm of productivity problems in software development or in web development. Silverlight, you don't have this problem. XAML's got all the answers.
All right. I think we finally warmed up enough to start recording.
I'm agreeing with you right now. I think the stuff before was blather.
I'll just leave it at that. Silverlight's the answer, and we'll just have a real short show this week.
Well, just in case we're actually going to wrap up, I'll say...
I think you should edit it and like just randomly order things. I think that's the only thing that could make this more sensible.
Then it would sound like every other podcast we do.
That's what Hanselman does when I go on his show.
All right, Mr. Ballware, is there anything coming up that's exciting? Anything you can promote?
I don't really have anything on the horizon, I think.
Not Christmas scheduled to is, speak Christmas anywhere?
I have the Lean Software Austin group here in town that I'm a facilitator with. I'm doing a session in January, and there's a IASA conference coming up. But aside from that, I'm hanging low, staying low, and you know, working right now to get a customer's business launched before January 1st. So just focused on that.
Oh, January 1st deadlines are the best.
Why is that?
Yes.
Just trying to get two people in the same room. Yeah.
It changes. It changes. It definitely changes the tone of your year end holidays. It sort of changes them to the tone of year end work days, I guess.
Nice.
Oh, 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 Merry Christmas! I'll be in my office. Now, I actually like working during this time of the year. I find it's nice and quiet, and you know, there's not a lot of people in the coffee houses sucking up the bandwidth. It's good. It's good. That's how I tell myself I'm not alone anyway.
I'm kind of having the same experience. I'm with just starting a new job December 1st. You know, I have no accrued vacation, and I'm kind of, and everyone else is out on vacation right now.
Right. Yeah. I don't know, man. I like when the, you know, spaces are quiet and the, you know, they have the ghosts of the people who are there, but you know, not their, you know, not their loud voices.
You work in isolation?
I sometimes work in isolation.
Yeah.
I like it's not by choice, damn it.
All right, let me put the wraps on this thing.
Oh yeah.
And then we can go on a tangent. John will keep recording.
Excellent.
Thank you, Scott, for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
For more hoarding code. Hoarding code. Let me do that again.
More working code?
Two. One, whoring code. Oh, wait, that's not right either. Thank you, Scott, for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. Bork, bork.
And thanks to you listeners who have been with us through all these times. Please tune in again. Good night and good luck.
Wow. Man, that was heavy.
I didn't know you were going to continue. I wouldn't have done the Bork Bork.
Very presidential.
Oh, you know.
Ask not what your podcast can do for you. Ask what you can do for your podcast.
I figure Obama wins the Peace Prize, Bernanke's Times Man of the Year. I should get something for
you
podcast.
You should get an Emmy.
Tiger is Sportsman of the Year.
Is he really?
Oh, yeah. No, sorry. Wait. Athlete of the Decade. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Decade.
I got that wrong.
Wow.
Was that sort of voted on before the shit hit the fan? Or
one would assume.
Was that the tiebreaker? All these women.
Not technically.
Athlete.
Have you seen the, what is it, the Women of Tiger calendar?
Can't be based on the Gregorian. There's only 12 months.
Right. Yeah, they had some like extra innings.
But it's a two-year calendar.
2011.
Oh, I just noticed that you guys were sending messages that whole time.
That's
not really.
that's where all the excitement was.
Yeah. So, God, yeah, I can't imagine that's going to be good. I'm really like, you know, I'm not freaked out about it, but I've done, you know.
John will feed your voice up. He'll do tricks.
No,
I really appreciate that.
I can do that if you'd like.
We'll cut in stuff from the other podcast.
Yeah, it happens.
I would like my voice to be put through a flanger.
We'll
I want to bring back the flanger. I think that the vocoder, I think, is just, you know, it's got too much.
It's overdone.
The flanger's ready for, you know, flanger is ready for a comeback. And not just flanger, but phaser too.
Yeah. And you put them together. The flanged phase is like, you can't beat it.
Oh, no, the flanged phase in the little, you know, that is automated to the attack of the note so that every note is flanged phased and has an auto wah on it. See the vocoder do that, man. Vocoder does one thing. It makes you sound like a robot.
Yeah.
Flanger auto timed phaser wah will make you sound like a god. Ask Jimi Hendrix.
That's right.
Ask Stevie Ray Vaughan. Did they use vocoders? No. Who's the guy that used the vocoder?
Hendrix didn't even have to tune up.
Didn't Peter Frampton use a vocoder?
Oh, yeah.
Was he a god?
Talk box, no.
Yeah,
no,
he was Peter Frampton.
Talk box, right?
That would be great if it was sung by Beaker. Did you guys see that Saturday Night Live thing where they all played the Muppets?
Oh, no.
Fuck. It's brilliant. They, like, what? There was, like, a, it was the monologue of Blake Lively.
You're dreaming, though.
I'm serious. And she's like, and one great thing about being in New York at Christmas time is I got to go see the Rockefeller lighting with the Muppets. And then the cast of Saturday Night Live, basically each one of them plays a Muppet. And they, like, come out and have this dialogue with her as Muppets. And it was just absolutely brilliant.
Wow, it's on Hulu.
It is on Hulu.
Gotta look this up.
What the hell is that?
Yeah, so, who's rocking out there?
So you're doing deep fried bites tomorrow night?
Nah, man. Nah, you're the only guys that'll have me. Everybody knows I'm a bit of a...
Yeah, right.
A bit ridiculous.
It seems like every guest we have these days is like, yeah, I'm doing your show, and oh, by the way, I've got three other podcasts this week.
And we always forget to ask, and then it's like, oh, crap.
Oh, man, you know...
You guys were the guys I thought of to have this
conversation with. I really think now that I should have gone with Hanselman, but, you know, it was a safe bet.
Oh, man.
Have you seen this clip from a, it's a British show? I can't remember what it's called. Now I won't be able to find it, will I? Damn it.
Well, you said British show. That narrows it down quite a bit.
It's just a clip where every time the guy, you know, he thinks he's a ladies' man, he walks up to the girls and he's like, so, you know, chatting him up. And then eventually they say, you know, well, I have a boyfriend. He just immediately says, f*** you, and walks off. One time he kicks her little schnauzer dog, f*** you, punts it across the street.
I think I have seen that.
That's what I'm thinking. We should, you know, be real nice to these guests when we come on. Yeah, we're really happy to have you on the show. And by the way, have you done any other podcasts? Well, yeah, I did. F*** you.
And just have it prearranged. That's what you do.
Right? Yeah, yep.
And play it out. Like, don't answer calls for, like, 2 days. Don't receive, like, block them on Twitter and shit. Let them sweat it out. You know, then it's like, oh, we're just kidding. We're just kidding. We might killed himself, huh?
Oh, well.
Unrelated.
Probably had some other things going on, whatever.
Couple.
Yep.
Wow. All right. So you want to start recording now?
Right. Okay. Well, awesome.
That's it.
Okay. Is Kay Scott, like, drumming?
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow. This is the first time I've heard this.
Oh, it is? Oh.
Yeah.
Well, every good talk show needs a band.
It was all the talk of flangers and phasers that just got me excited.
How can we work this into the show?
Definitely got to work this in. Are you still recording this, John?
I am.
You should have Kay Scott play the intro music.
All right. Go ahead.
Assuming he can actually play the drums.
Oh, like right now?
Yeah, and then I'll put in the voices right over the top. It'll be special music this week.
Oh, man. On my laptop? I don't know how that'll work. How's that?
Have you heard our intro music before?
It's about like that.
Oh, sorry, welcome to Herding Cody!
That's a take.
I need more shots.
All right, gentlemen. Good luck with that.
All right. Okay. Good night, guys.
Later.
Bye.